Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Welcome to the Scott Radley Show for this Monday evening. A gorgeous Monday out there. Finally, it feels like we're getting into some of the good stuff. Welcome to the show. It's, man, feeling good today. I mean, tomorrow, when the budget arrives, maybe a different feeling. Federal budget is coming and a lot of angst about what's coming, but we'll deal with that tomorrow. But today, a lot of good stuff. A lot, you know, you feel good out there. It's just that suddenly it feels like things are okay. Summer's coming. Welcome to the show. We have much to get to today. We're going to be chatting at the bottom of the hour about numbers of Hamilton Elementary School kids more and more staying home with illnesses since the pandemic. Since the pandemic has happened, it seems as though it's more normalized for people to stay home. Is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? I mean, I suppose on the one hand you say good because then everyone else doesn't get sick. On the other hand, my goodness, our kids have missed so much school in person over the last few years. It seems a problem any day they miss now, but we'll get into that at the bottom of the hour. Don Robertson will be here next hour, as he always is. As always, the first segment of the Scott Radley Show brought to you exclusively by fox40shop.com for sport and for safety. It has to be fox40shop.com. Enter the promo code Radley at checkout and you will get 25% off your order. Let's get right into it though today because, as I say, we've got a lot to get to. And a very interesting, the LRT, as you know, we talked about it last week a little bit. We may talk about it more this week, but the LRT is back in the news for all kinds of reasons. It's going to be up at City Council. Actually, I think it's planning or general issues, I can't remember, on Wednesday. But there's another part of this that's really interesting. Last week, the federal Liberals, was it last week? The week before, anyway, recently came out with a housing announcement that was supposed to help municipalities, but it came with certain conditions. And one of these conditions could have some significant impact on Hamilton. Let me bring in John Best. He is the publisher of the Bay Observer. He is a man. We have him on regularly. We love having him on. John, how are you today?
Just great, thanks.
Appreciate you doing this, especially with this, because it's such an interesting scenario that has somehow quickly arisen with this housing proposal from the federal government. And basically, to keep it very simple, people can go to the Bay Observer and read more about this. They want more details. But in the simplest possible way, one of the conditions of handing over many, many, many millions of dollars to municipalities, Hamilton in particular, to build housing is, or for transit, is that you have to unlock housing. You have to make it available, especially in places like along transit lines. Well, that's an interesting one for Hamilton, isn't it, John?
Well, it is. And with, I mean, we've always known that, housing developments along transit routes were going to get preferential treatment, in terms of, we've got two governments here that are controlling things, but the province has certainly said that, they'd be prepared to relax some of the height, restrictions and some of those kind of things, some of the density restrictions along transit routes. But the feds took it one step further with their big series of announcements last week, and they released a ton of paperwork. But anyway, what I found interesting was even the plainness of the wording. This is a government backgrounder, and it says any community that wants transit funding will be required to take action that will directly unlock housing supply. And then they provide some for instances, and one of them is eliminating the mandatory minimum parking requirements along the route. And of course, that was one of the reasons that was given when at the Committee of Adjustment, when the councillor for Ward 3 opposed the Vrancor project. She said, well, there's only 37 parking spots. And, that's way less than what is needed. But what we're getting now from the feds is that we won't have those mandatory minimum parking requirements. So it's another sort of, It seems to me that both governments, and to be fair to our local planning departments, both the feds and the province seem to be saying with their various policies that the biggest impediment to getting houses built are local planning departments. And they're putting, they're making all these changes, and basically, some of these subdivision planning restrictions that have been in place for, decades and decades, they're just saying to hell with it. We need to build houses, and a lot of these rules about shading and massing and all of that, notwithstanding a couple of stories you had in your news today, it seems like it's going to be tougher to make that case.
Well, so a couple things that you just said, and I want to just back up for people if somebody doesn't know. So first of all, the federal government has a big say in our LRT because they're right now on the hook for half of it. They've agreed to pay for half. So we take away the federal funding, LRT is dead in the water to begin with. So we have to be listening to them when it comes to their ideas about housing. If you want the LRT, you have to then do what they want with housing. We're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place, are we not?
Yeah, that in essence is I think what's being said here, that if you want transit money, whether it's LRT or, the federal government and the provincial government also play a major role in simply helping with the purchase of buses. I think it's almost like a one-third, one-third, one-third kind of an arrangement. So this could have serious impact even on the city plans. They've got plans right now to replace more than a dozen buses every year, and they want to switch the diesel buses that still remain. They want to switch them all to natural gas. So this is a big deal, and it needs to be dealt with as housing projects come up for consideration, because a developer it makes a big difference to a developer whether they have to provide 200 parking spaces or maybe a lot less, and it would certainly bring down the cost of building the building. The question would remain, what happens to all the cars?
Well, and the Vrancor thing that you mentioned, and this is really interesting because this seems to be the flashpoint. This has already been something that was red flags were raised about this by staff, but also by the counselor for Ward 3, by Narinder Nan. And this would, though, seem to be the one, the obvious example to begin with, right? I mean, there's other ones that are going to come along, but this one is sitting there like a shining light. What are you going to do with this one? It seems like an obvious thing to have to deal with right off the bat.
Yeah, because the project, even though it was opposed at Committee of Adjustment, and they withdrew their application to Committee of Adjustment, it was a bit of a technical move, but the reason they did that was because if they actually got turned down at Committee of Adjustment, it would make it very difficult to bring that project back. So where it sits right now is it's still being considered by Community Housing Hamilton. And I had some communication with those folks last week, and they have listed it as a project that they are considering. So to me, it may shine a little glimmer of hope on that project, frankly, depending on, and of course there's other projects, because anybody that's bought property along the LRT route can look at this now and say, this is a significant change in the kind of proposal that we might have brought forward, given that they're eliminating the parking requirements, or certainly reducing. Well, they use the word eliminating. So I don't know whether that means you could put a proposal forward with no parking, but it certainly means that these ratios that we've been using are probably not valid if you're looking to get federal transit money. And I don't know anybody that's not looking for federal transit money.
Talking about the Vrancor spot proposal, there are others. I have no doubt that there will be councillors who will make other proposals in other wards, who will then create some interesting situations, I would think, here for the mayor, because the mayor, a month or so ago, flexed her strong mayor powers for that parking lot in Stony Creek. What happens now if there is a spot in another ward, like Vrancor, that can't get passed? Is she almost obligated now to do this again?
Well, I posed that question to her office, actually, a couple of weeks ago, just after she announced that she was going to invoke the strong mayor powers. And, you know, and I asked them directly, I said, what are you going to do about this Vrancor project? And what are you going to do about the Philpott Church project in Ward 2? I wasn't expecting an explicit answer, and I certainly didn't get one. I got kind of a word salad. But somewhere in there, she mentioned being in favor of affordable housing all across Hamilton. So there was kind of a, you know, aspirational statement, but really definitely ducked my very direct questions about what are you going to do about these two projects. So, you know, I think it is certainly, I think it is going to put pressure to act in other cases. And if it doesn't, I think it's just going to stir things up. You know, the people in Stony Creek are pretty upset right now. You got three councillors that are pretty unhappy about the way the matter was handled, and it's not going to get any better, obviously, if there doesn't seem to be some even-handedness about some of these projects. And yet today, the city put out a news release saying, we're talking about the Philpott Church project, that they're gonna designate it as a historical site or a heritage site. So that's a roadblock that will certainly have an impact on that project.
I really think it's also going to be a really interesting look at council, because we had, and look, I know that all the discussion is about fiefdoms and, you know, we shouldn't have little kingdoms. We should be looking for the betterment of the city. And that's, you know, that's all fine. So people taking shots at the Stony Creek councilors for saying you didn't want housing here, that's fine. But it's going to be really interesting if those councillors who didn't represent the Stony Creek area, who pushed very hard for that parking lot to be turned into affordable housing against the wishes of the local community, don't allow housing to go with their blessing in their own ward, even if there may be some pushback from local members of the community. This becomes a really interesting, I think, almost gauge of something. I'm not sure exactly what, but of something about how councillors handle this.
Well, I had an interesting conversation on the weekend with MP Chad Collins, who in fact represented the same area that Matt Francis is now representing, which is East Hamilton and downtown Stony Creek. And he told me that now he was always very heavy on the housing file as a councillor. He headed the Community Housing Authority for a number of years. And since he's gone to Ottawa, he's headed up a housing caucus. So he's still keeping his hand very much in housing. He told me that when he was on council, he went to a number of his council colleagues and said, what could you come up with in your ward that would be suitable for affordable housing? And a number of them came forward. A number of the ones that got defeated, frankly, came forward. So those projects were launched, some years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, and some of them are just about ready to open now. And the comment he made to me at the end of the discussion, he said, you know, that's the reason I went directly to the councillors and asked them to come up with properties voluntarily, rather than what we see in Stony Creek. And he was clearly, you know, he was polite in his language, but obviously he wasn't very impressed with the way this Stony Creek thing happened, because in that case, the councillor, certainly Matt Francis, I can remember when it first came up in December, when he asked for time to, confer with the community, that it had blindsided him. And so, you know, there's a different ways of doing things, and sometimes the big brother approach isn't the way to go.
It's an interesting idea. I mean, I almost wish, and I know I'm dreaming in Technicolor here, John, but I almost wish after this one in Stony Creek that the mayor had said, as the leader of council, you know what, we pushed this one through But for the next council meeting or two council meetings from now, I want one suggestion from every councilor in their ward. Please bring it forward. Let's make it happen. I didn't hear that. I haven't heard anybody on council voluntarily, unless I missed it, voluntarily offering one up since then. But boy, that would be some real leadership on this file.
Well, and to your comment about, you know, we don't want these wards to become fiefdoms or whatever, absolutely right. But Colin's point was you should at least start there. Start with the counselor because, you know, they're attending local meetings. They're plugged into their community. And bottom line is they know what they can sell to their community and what won't work. And certainly, as it's turned out, I did another story that it looks to me like it's going to be 4 years minimum before anything gets built on those two parking lots. And there are so many projects, so many affordable housing projects in the pipe right now, many of which are seeking funding. They haven't even been funded yet. So where are these two parking lots going to go? They're not going to go ahead of projects that are already on the books. So, you know, we could be... We're certainly going to be well into the next term of council before anything happens in Stony Creek.
Yeah, I just, as I say, I go back to my point, though. I really think that after this was such a contentious issue that really split council and, you know, phrases like parking over people and all these, you know, really hot button issues, it would have been an impressive show of leadership to say, I agree, I understand why Matt Francis and Jeff Beatty and Brad Clark, who represent Stony Creek, I understand they're upset. I understand that this was not ideal for them. So to show that this was not about making it in someone else's backyard, here's the property, it's a well-used thing, but it could be great for housing. Here is a place on my in my ward that I am putting forward to do this. That to me would have been something that showed bringing council together and showing we're all in this together. I haven't seen that yet.
Community building, it's called, and there's no question this issue was clumsily handled from the get-go. It brought out the worst in some of our councilors. Some of the things they said and proposed during that debate were just really quite appalling.
That is John Best. He is the publisher of the Bay Observer. John, always appreciate having you on. Thanks for doing this today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Scott Radley Show here on 900 CHML. Pretty sure my next guest has heard that song 1,000,000,000 times because she is one of the, if not the best education analyst in this country. Her name is Annie Kidder. Annie, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. I was actually thinking that exact thing.
Is that right? Well,
thinking,
you know,
there must be another song. There's the, you know, there's the other one that has counting, and I've forgotten what it is. I don't know. We need more education songs anyway.
We wanted to have Annie on today because it's a fascinating situation going on, not only in the Hamilton-Wentworth District School Board, but really across Canada. And what we're seeing is, especially in elementary schools, more than in high schools, I believe, we are seeing a much higher rate of kids missing school since coming back from the pandemic. Some of it is because of illness, and maybe parents are now more inclined to leave their kid at home when they're sick now than they would have been before, and maybe that's a positive thing, I'm not sure. But there's other things too. They are parents pointing to bullying that's not being taken care of. There are parents saying, my kid needs a mental health day. There's parents who are now working from home and saying, I'll keep my kid home. Annie, let's leave out for a second the idea of your kid has a cold and so now I'm willing to let them stay home. Because we can debate all day long whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think most people would say that makes sense. Mm-hmm. These other ones, though, seem like they are new, and I'm not sure if I should be looking at the school boards and the schools to say you're doing something wrong, or if parents are now just more open to having their kids stay home, which I don't know it's a great thing.
Well, I think there's something wrong. I thought it was a really shocking story and shocking that it's being seen across Canada. And it's definitely worth trying to find out more about the why of it. But I think that, you know, this is totally non-scientific because I read this story on the CBC website, but it felt as if overall there was a sense of a kind of diminished sort of trust in schools that, you know, I need to send my kid every day and that my child will be taken care of and educated properly and that, you know, they're a good, important, vital place for my child to be. So when I read it, I was really surprised and shocked, especially about, I mean, the numbers are there for Hamilton, for both the Hamilton Public and Catholic boards, and they've gone up enormously in terms of the proportion of kids who are away for more than 10 days, I think, in a year, which is, you know, named chronic absenteeism. So to me, it's a signal of something, again, and I'm not sure we're sure what, but it's a signal that we should really be looking at and taking seriously.
Last year, the story says, and the study shows, that over half of Hamilton's public elementary students missed 18 days of school or more. So you're talking almost a month worth of school. Now, I can't remember. I should have looked this up ahead of time. You'll know it. There is a requirement that schools have a certain number of school days a year. I can't remember what that mm-hmm. number is. I think it's like 170 or something.
Yeah.
But if you're taking out 20 of those, like, so imagine mm-hmm. school starts on Labor Day and you're deciding I'm not showing up until October. And
yeah.
I mean, it's a crazy number. And it, and you know, Annie, there's a number of things here that I worry about. I worry about the fact that we don't fail anybody anymore. So if you're missing all that time and we're still pushing you through, I worry mm-hmm. that kids are not prepared for next grade and it only builds on itself. That's a big one. Would you agree?
Well, I think I'm not sure about that one, only because the evidence is actually failing them doesn't help. But to your, you know, the substance of your point, which is that, are they actually learning all the things they need to learn in every grade? That you know, definitely, that is a lot of school to miss every year.
Yeah, and so with especially all the time that they missed during COVID, there is mm-hmm. a cohort of students here that I am very concerned when they pop out in grade 12. Mm-hmm. What have they got, or what have they missed?
But and also, like, what's happened to them? Like, if you think of COVID as this huge kind of bomb that went off in all of our lives, but especially if you think of young children, you know, that it was a huge percentage of their lives already, the experience of COVID. So, and then, you know, so that kind of destabilized them. Then finally school starts again. And in Ontario, they missed more days of school than anywhere in the country, I think. So then you get back to school and suddenly school seems, I don't know. I mean, and this is where, you know, there needs to be really good research and, you know, conversations with families to understand what's going on. But does school no longer seem as if it's the stable, secure, kind of same place it used to? And in that case, what should we, you know, the grand we, policymakers, the government, people looking at this, what should everybody be doing right now in a pretty urgent way to, in order to make, I don't know, in order to rebuild that idea of an education system that people can count on, that they feel is not, I mean, we just put out a report last month on the incredible staff shortages. There's a lot of stress and strain on schools, and it feels as if then kids are actually kids and their families are experiencing it. This is a symptom of something else. And I'm sorry not to be very articulate.
Well, no, your point, I mean, one of the things that a number of people have pointed out in the story and in the study is that kids are needing mental health days. And mm-hmm. so I'm, again, trying to decide, okay, have schools become so difficult that kids can't deal with it? Or there is the alternative, and that is that parents and kids have become soft and anything. So we now basically say, well, you don't have to go. Where I grew up, now I understand not everyone is the same. Yeah. My dad, you know, my dad was an educated guy. He was an academic. And if you could get up to watch TV at home, you were healthy enough to get up to go to school. But it almost seems like, is it that schools are that bad now? Or have we decided coming through the pandemic, yeah, we're okay if you stay home and miss a day or two, you'll probably feel a little happier.
Or is kids' mental health, you know, so kind of undermined by the whole experience?
Absolutely.
Like, all of these things are questions. And I think it's, you know, it would probably turn out it's not absolutely one or the other. But, you know, but the most important thing is, to really, truly try to understand what's going on and then really, truly try to make sure that something's being done about it. I mean, we have been, you know, like a broken record since the beginning of the pandemic saying there needs to be a task force or a partnership table, or we need to have a big, comprehensive, coherent look at what's happening in our education system. And that includes everything that happened from the pandemic, the disruption of that. But
the Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening. And do not forget to subscribe to this podcast.
Your expertise is not necessarily in childhood mental health. It's an education.
But boy, oh boy, if we have this many kids
and review us
that are having this much mental health issues that they require this many mental health days, we got to find out what is the cause of this, because boy, oh boy, we're walking into a dangerous area, because this is not then just about school.
No, and that you're absolutely right. And the thing is, school is never just about school either, because this is like our whole next generation of society we're educating here. And these are, you know, this is our hope for the future, and, you know, people who will grow up to solve the mess of the world that we're leaving them. Sorry, that, you know, I know that's not really funny, but also to live in a complex, rapidly changing world. So if And I think we've seen lots and lots of reports saying this across the country, that more kids are struggling with their mental health than ever before. So if that's true, what are we, and we can't just wait till they're in crisis, and schools are the place where, you know, 95% of our kids are. What do we need to be doing in schools? How do we need to recognize this and make sure that we're dealing with this as a really serious, urgent problem? That we're not just hoping will go away. And I think that this data from Hamilton is incredibly important, and a kind of, it's a signal that we have to really listen to and do something about.
That is Annie Kidder, who, by the way, I forgot to introduce right off the top. I mean, I said she was one of Canada's, if not Canada's, greatest educational analysts. She's also the executive director of People for Education. I got to get that in at some point so people know who I'm talking to.
Thank you.
Annie, always appreciate you taking time. Thanks for doing this today.
Okay, thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
History is made by stupid people. Clever people wouldn't even try. If you want a place in the history books, then do something dumb before you die.
It is 6:51 on a lovely Monday here in Hamilton. Time for Tom's story of the day. Tom is in today, holding down the fort, doing all the hard work, pressing buttons and shoveling coal into the furnace and everything else that's required for the technical operator. So, Tom, are you ready to do this?
Oh, as ready as I'll ever be.
Here's how this works for those who don't know. For the first timers here, I give Tom three unusual stories from around the world. Tom will consider those stories, and he will then decide which one he likes best, and that becomes Tom's story of the day. Very, very simple, Tom. So let us begin in London, England today, where a couple went to a lawyer to, they were having some marital issues. It appears they were not looking to split things off. They were just, you know, wanting to, I don't know exactly what they were wanting to do, but anyway, they went to the lawyer. The lawyer made a slight boo-boo, and I guess the English family court system has mostly automated stuff and with no-fault divorces. Anyway, the solicitors at the London firm Vardags accidentally pressed a button on a particular website, and the couple is now officially divorced.
I didn't realize it was that easy.
They did not. I didn't either. But the law firm then said, oh, wait, we didn't mean to do that. And the court says, too bad, we don't have any kind of mechanism to undo it. So after 21 years together, they are officially divorced and will now, I guess, have to, I don't know what kind of process you have to go through. Could they get remarried tomorrow and just keep all their stuff? I do not know, but this seems like it's a bit of a mess. A slight bit of a mess.
Have they made it Facebook official, though?
Good question. Story number two, and I'll tell you why in a second, why we've got this one on the list. But a guy in Spruce Grove, Alberta, has been the subject of a prank that's been going on for 6 months now that he is not happy about. Seems that somebody keeps ordering pizzas and keeps sending it to his home and workplace, and he has to tell then the delivery person, I didn't order this, I'm not paying for it.
Oh, yeah.
Which is getting him yelled at by delivery people and pizza store employees and all the rest when he keeps turning it around and sending it home. You would think that the pizza stores would eventually catch on that, you know, 123 Mills Lane, whatever, would be no longer a place you deliver pizza, which makes it tough if he really wants to order a pizza at some point.
That's true. You However, probably have to go to Homemade.
The reason that I mentioned this one and the reason why I kind of, in a sick way, like this story is because I did this prank on somebody one time. A person who was getting married, myself and a number of other people, on their honeymoon night, on their wedding night, we arranged so every 15 minutes we had a pizza delivered to their hotel room.
Okay, that's...
Now, we didn't do it for months on end.
Yeah, restraint is the key.
And presumably, and I assume they did just ignore the knocking on the door. Probably had a pile. Now, the other thing was, we didn't do this practical joke all that well because we paid for the pizza.
Yeah.
On our credit card. So the pizza probably there was, I never asked because I assumed that they knew who it was, but I didn't really want to give it away. But I assumed by the end of the night, they probably had 15 pizza boxes stacked up outside the room. They could have had pizza for their whole honeymoon.
I know. Would have been pretty nice of you, actually.
Story number three. Have you ever played Yu-Gi-Oh?
Oh, yes.
Okay, Yu-Gi-Oh. It's a card game, right?
Yep.
So I guess they have tournaments. I don't know what level. I don't know if they have, like, world championships.
Oh, they do.
Okay, so anyway, there was a Yu-Gi-Oh tournament, and I'm trying to find where it was. In a Japanese tournament, all right? So it's this tournament, a Yu-Gi-Oh tournament is in Japan. Makes sense, because that probably is a Japanese word, is it not?
It kind of spawned from an anime.
Okay. A person who was a leading contender to win the entire tournament pulled out of the tournament because the person she was stuck sitting next to, according to her, smelled so bad could no longer continue.
Yeah, this is an ongoing problem among Yu-Gi-Oh, Pokemon cards, Magic the Gathering,
bad
Warhammer.
Hygiene.
Yeah, like there is that stereotype of the neckbearded nerd who has never seen a bar of soap in their life and doesn't plan on acquainting themselves with one anytime soon.
Well, she said, I left halfway through because I couldn't stand the smell. And then when someone said it was hilarious, she goes, it was no laughing matter, and urged them to take a bath that it was so bad that she could no longer sit there and breathe through it.
Yeah.
And you know what? I don't have experience at a Yu-Gi-Oh tournament, but having flown on a flight next to someone who probably had not bathed since the previous solar eclipse to the one we just had, I get it. I get it. You are locked in. You are trapped. And there is nothing. Now, she thankfully was able to, you know, walk away and leave, but it cost her the tournament. Anyway, will your story of the day today be the couple who accidentally got a divorce when their lawyer pressed the wrong button on the website? Will it be the guy who is the subject of a prank that keeps getting pizza delivered to him and getting him in trouble with the pizza delivery people? Or will it be the Yu-Gi-Oh tournament with the horrendous BO that cost one of the leading players the tournament?
I got to stick with my nerds. It's the Yu-Gi-Oh tournament. I've been on the business end of one of those.
Yeah, I would agree with you. That would have been mine today, and I completely understand. And it's just, there is almost nothing. Well, I was going to say there's almost nothing worse. There's probably a few things that are as bad.
Yeah.
The sound of someone vomiting
is
a real problem. There are other things, but there are not many things worse than being stuck next to someone who just smells like their armpits are made of brie. It's just horrible. Anyway, there you go. There's Tom's story of the day. The stinky Yu-Gi-Oh people. If this is you, take this piece of advice from a man who knows. Tom has been the guy you have tormented. Bathe, then play. That's how it works.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
All right, let me bring in, see, I always introduce him the same way. He's the owner and operator of the Dundas Real McCoys, who will be launching the Allen Cup in a bit. We'll talk about that today. He is the owner of ComChoice Realty. He is the 2014 Dundas Citizen of the Year. And now, as of last week, as we announced here live on the show, we can add a new thing. He is a new member of the Hamilton Police Services Board, taking on a whole new challenge. His name is Don Robertson. How are you? Congratulations.
Thank you.
Or my sympathies, one or the other.
We will see.
Yeah, that is a huge thing to undertake.
Yeah, it's we'll find out. I mean, I haven't been to a meeting, and I'm sure it's a complex file, and we will get into it as need be. And who knows? I generally like challenges, and there's no evidence this won't be one of them.
Mm, I would agree with that. For the most part, almost exclusively, we will steer clear of police board stuff when you're here on Monday nights. This is a sports discussion, so we won't do that. But,
they,
you know.
They won't need to wonder what I'm thinking.
That's probably very true.
Yeah.
That is probably very true. I'm sure you'll make many friends. So, speaking of making friends, last time you were here, we were maybe mentioning the fact, and it was just last week, that there was talk about what's going to happen with hockey in Arizona. In the span of a week, this thing's been going on for how many years now, where this thing has been, the Arizona Coyotes have been a mess. And in the span of a week, suddenly, the entire world has changed, and they're on their way to Salt Lake City, it appears.
It appears that way. And with a bunch of young guys, too. You know, I heard a couple interviews with the owners, young guy whose name escapes me. But, you know, they're talking about a new arena. They're talking about doing an awful lot of exciting things.
In Arizona. Or in Salt Lake.
Salt Lake.
In Salt Lake, yeah. Well, they're talking about it in Arizona, too. Problem is, it just never happens.
Good point. And I thought that the NHL were going to bide their time till June to see if the Arizona group could buy this chunk of real estate and build an entertainment district. But it looks like the rag and the puck in Arizona is coming to an end. Now, the rumor I heard is that if, in fact, this team moves to Salt Lake City, the owner of Arizona can still hold a placeholder for a team in Arizona if they get the arena built.
Based on everything we've seen from the Arizona Coyotes over the past whatever number of years, would you put money that it's going to all come together?
No, but I don't think it costs the National Hockey League anything to say, all right, Radley, if you can finally build an arena, if you can finally do all those things, we'll give you
an expansion team.
An expansion franchise. And in actual fact, the move to Salt Lake may indicate that there is expansion coming.
Except, you know, the thing about this that's so ridiculous is you can go and say, yeah, okay, we'll give you an expansion team in Arizona, while Quebec City is sitting there being unused. What I don't get from this whole thing, Don, is the Players Association saying nothing, apparently, or at least not publicly, because the salary cap is based on revenues, and you're going to make a whole lot more revenues in a hockey market than you are in Arizona.
Well, I think the Players Association have made their concerns.
You think so?
Felt. Well, according to valued newspaper reports, the guy that runs the Players Association now has brought it up on more than one occasion.
Okay. All right.
That you're kind of hurting the salary cap here because you can't even sell out your 4,300-seat building.
Yeah, the irony of this whole thing is that Arizona would be right to the front of the line for an expansion team. To me, Arizona should be like number six on the list for an expansion team because there's a lot of places that I would go first.
Would you go back to Atlanta for a third time?
Nope.
We're talking about
that. Yeah, I know. It's like, okay, let's go to Arizona and Atlanta. This is like someone had a blackout drunk for the last 20 years and forgot what had happened and were, you know, and then, hey, I got a great idea. Let's go to Arizona and Atlanta. Those seem like two positive hockey markets.
Well, they both start with an A, other than that.
And they both end with an F.
The only positive side of going back to Atlanta is it may give Quebec City an opportunity to get that team in a few years.
Yeah, you're probably, yeah, that's what I, you're bang on. Now that you mention it, you're bang on. Arizona and Atlanta are basically the future Houston and Quebec City franchises.
Or Hamilton.
Yeah, you're going to tell me that Hamilton's in the mix?
I don't. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, I don't see that happening.
I'm not saying that, no.
It should, put it this way, it should before Atlanta or Arizona gets another team, but I don't see it ever happening. Though, you know, the one guy, though, that would be interesting to me, I've heard, maybe you heard this too, there have been rumors rumbling around, and I don't know that there's anything to them. I haven't followed them up, so maybe something came out recently. But there were rumors that Larry Tannenbaum, the guy who's the sort of the one face of the
one private owner.
Yeah, but, and the one guy you've ever seen, because the rest of the Leaf ownership is just corporate. So,
Rogers, I can imagine the board meetings would be fun.
Yeah. But he's the one guy that I've heard rumors that he may sell his shares. I don't know that there's a hint of truth to this, but it was an interesting idea. And if he were to walk out with a couple $1 billion from MLSE, that's an interesting one. Just bring a team to Hamilton and you're now the competitor with your old franchise, and he would have the dough to do it. Now, I have zero idea if he's interested. I have zero idea if the MLSE people would be interested in negotiating with him for territorial rights. I have no idea about any of it, but that's the one guy that you would look at and go, oh, maybe.
Yeah, there are no territorial rights anymore for the National Hockey League, as I understand it. It's just a majority vote that if the majority say yes. And Larry Tannenbaum is not brand new.
No.
He has leveraged and put himself in a fabulous position to become more successful and more wealthy than he has in the past, and he started off in pretty good financial shape. If I'm him and I have that plan, I exercise that plan on my way out, that everybody knows I'm selling because I'm putting a team in Hamilton. And I don't follow the art scene in Hamilton as much as some people do, but his dad, I believe it was, made a pretty substantial donation to the Hamilton Art Gallery. And Larry has befriended it as well. So there is some attachment to Hamilton. I don't know what it is, but he lives in the Big Smoke. And if they're helping Hamilton, maybe.
It would be interesting. I can't see any other. And that could be, you know, I'm loath to start the whole NHL to Hamilton rumor mill again, because it's not. That's the one. I only mention it because that's the one guy that you could look at and say, he's got a history with this. He would have the money. Maybe he has some interest. But I can't imagine there's anybody else right now who would look at Hamilton as the be-all and end-all and would have the dough to do that. Maybe they would.
Well, I mean, what did Andlar pay? $1 billion?
Roughly, I think, yeah.
For Ottawa, maybe a smidge more. And he's a pretty bright guy. That's got to make a franchise in Hamilton worth $1 billion plus.
If he's
done his math.
If it was an expansion team, the NHL would be squeezing every dime. You'd be $1.5 billion.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
But the numbers have to work. And the TV numbers, it'll be interesting to see what happens after the Rogers $750 trillion deal to hold all the NHL rights for playoffs and everything else. It'll be interesting to see what Gary Bettman does there. Gary Bettman is a very, very clever guy. And he always seems to be able to make chicken salad out of chicken feathers. I was careful.
Or that. Other parts.
Yeah. So I think there'll be good dollars coming in TV-wise. But the rumors I've heard are that there might be a lot more regional deals that are probably better for the areas and the teams. And, you know, like the Rangers have drawn a lot of dough. The Leafs will. Montreal will. Phoenix probably wouldn't. They could probably be on the local cable network. So we'll see. I think financially it will work in Hamilton because you can almost like-price Toronto. So there's no embarrassment of being Toronto light when it comes to the charging for popcorn and pop and beer and tickets. You could be 60% and probably make it work.
Well, do you remember when, and many people listening will remember, when before Winnipeg got their team and they had that whole Make It Seven campaign for a seventh Canadian NHL team. And I remember talking to broadcasting people at the time, and their comment was, the TV deal that exists for TV in Canada isn't based on, it's for the country. And so when Winnipeg gets added, or if Hamilton was added, essentially think of them as silos, because if you try and turn on a game, they're blacked out in certain regions. So the Hamilton market would add probably almost zero new hockey fans. You wouldn't be growing the base per se, just like Winnipeg didn't really grow the base. They were hockey fans already. Now they're Winnipeg Jets fans, but they were still watching Hockey Night in Canada. So the idea was, by adding another team in Canada, you're not bringing in a whole lot more revenue. You're just splitting it more.
Well, yeah, and you're cannibalizing, right? I mean, you're right, guys in Hamilton
who were Leaf fans or Canadiens fans are now Hamilton whatever fans.
Yeah, and you know, there's all kinds of Bruins jersey around, Bill Kelly. But eventually they become Hamilton fans. I mean, I've been a Leaf fan my whole life.
But how many people in this area don't ever watch hockey who will suddenly become fans? There'll be some.
Yeah, no, but it's not. It'll be marginal.
Yes.
But they may watch more often. Like if Hamilton had its own franchise, and you know everybody in the surrounding area wants to rally behind it, where they may be a casual Hockey Night in Canada fan or Leaf fan, they would become more committed if there was a Hamilton team they could cheer for. So you might get more eyeballs that way, but it's not going to be like brand new. It's only 40 million people in Canada.
And the other thing, and as I was mentioning about the silos, one of the things that I was forgetting was when I talked to those broadcast people, one of the things they point out is it's expensive to produce a game. You have to move the truck. You have to bring the whole staff, everything else. So now you've got the Maple Leafs have the enormous thing. However Hamilton's team might do, you're paying an awful lot of money for probably not massive local ratings. Or a massive, not probably a massive, because the Leafs will argue that the game should probably, that Hamilton games would probably be blacked out in their market.
I'm going to do what I'm really good at. I'm going to talk like an expert about something I know nothing about. If you build a new arena in Hamilton, and you would need a new arena in Hamilton, unless this expansion is going to be two corridors. But in all, let's go with the premise that you're going to build a new building, like they did when they built the Sky Dome. They will build all the infrastructure for TV broadcasts within the building. I mean, I remember a few decades ago going to a Toronto Maple Leaf game and remembering these great big tractor trailers
outside
and all that stuff on the back of the of Carlton Street and thinking how cool that was. Well, now, I I'm no wizard at producing hockey games, although I've been in on some calls with Chris or Rod Black and Rick Vive and everybody else that's going to do the game, championship game for the McCoys, so I'm getting a little bit better at it. But any new building, I'm sure, would have a broadcast center in it because there's going to be lots of stuff to broadcast. So you don't need a truck. You just need a $75 gazillion studio.
But if you – okay, so – and again, we're not trying to start the rumor, but this is the whole idea of the Arizona getting an expansion team and why wouldn't Hamilton? Okay, so – if you, though, are in Hamilton, if you are the owner of a team in Hamilton, probably you're going to want Leaf games blacked out in this region because you want to have access to the market. Does that grow anything, or does that just tick people off then?
I don't. Would they do that? I mean, sometimes I'm now on.
Would the Leafs black out the Hamilton games into their market? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the rink board rights are always interesting, eh? Because, good Canadian kid. because I ask about our broadcast of the Allen Cup Championship game, which Cable 14 are going to do and CHCH are going to carry. I ask them if they had the technology to place the rink boards on the TV without the rink boards being up, thinking it would save some money not putting rink boards up. And they don't have that technology, not surprisingly enough. And then I was talking to Barry Forth last Saturday, Copetown Woods Open, if anybody didn't know. And he said it's a camera. Mm. I wasn't aware of that. You know, if you're watching hockey game, any televised game, where you might see CHML on all the rink boards all of a sudden.
And then it moves, and then it's gone, it's something else.
And then it's Calm Choice Real Estate the way it should be and everything else. That that's all done from one, that technology is all from one camera. Because if you see different angles or you see a play in the corner and they go to a different camera, you see the host or rink boards of that arena on the boards. And they're not what you see with the technology they've got, but it's all done through a camera. And I don't imagine I don't imagine they picked that camera up at Walmart.
Yeah, no, the whole thing, it's such an interesting, I don't believe for a second that there's ever going to be a team in Hamilton. I think the amount of money that would be involved is too much. I think there's a lot of different reasons now that you'd have to, as you say, a new arena or at least a lot more money in the arena, lots of things. But when they talk about let's let the team leave Arizona to go to Salt Lake City, and Arizona's top of the list for an expansion team, I shake my head. You've done everything for 20 something years. The only thing that Arizona hockey has ever done right is created Auston Matthews.
And they did a good job of that.
That is a good job they did. So, the rest of it has been a disaster. A disaster.
So if the National Hockey League, in fact, do that, they say, okay, you guys are going to Salt Lake City, and when you get your act together and put an arena, you'll be at the top of the list. How scared do you think they are that that arena deal will ever get done? Because it's been 20 years, and they haven't done it.
But they did an arena deal, right? They did that. They did the one in, you know what I mean?
Where the football team plays.
Yeah. So they had one in Phoenix.
Yeah.
Then they went to Glendale.
Glendale. Yeah.
And it was a disaster, as it turns out. So, what's – I just don't understand if you are Gary Bettman, and you're right, Gary Bettman's a smart guy, but at a certain point, do you not say, how much of my legacy and reputation am I staking on this thing that they've tried a bunch of things, and it just has not worked? It just hasn't worked. Yeah. And we gave it a best shot, but to say immediately we're coming back there, you get a rink, I would say, you know what? You get a rink and you sell 15,000 season tickets on a 10-year minimum purchase. That you lock in 15,000 season tickets for 10 years, then we'll consider it. But you know what's going to happen? They're going to get the rink and they're going to come out with a flourish in the first year, and they'll have 10,000 season tickets, and the team will stink as they always do, and they'll whittle down to 3,000 season tickets, and the team will be in trouble immediately. Immediately.
Not a direct comparison. The Winnipeg Jets, when they moved there, everybody had to commit to 3 years season tickets.
Right.
Pretty smart.
That was the smart way to do it, for sure.
But look
at them now.
Winnipeg, you would think, is almost a hockey mecca in Manitoba, in central Canada. They're not selling out the second smallest arena in the National
Hockey
League.
Exactly. With a great team.
With a potential Stanley Cup contender.
So you're now going to say Winnipeg is struggling. Other places, you know, with the economy and everything else, could be places that could have a problem. But Arizona, we're really confident going back to Arizona. We know that this time it's going to be a winner. Same with Atlanta. Somebody needs to pee into a cup and have a test done, because something is not right. If your two top prospects are Atlanta and Arizona, something is not right.
Well, apparently they're not. They're leaving Arizona.
Well, I know, but, you know, and when I talk about, you know, Hamilton, quite frankly, I'm not even going to be in the lobbying group for Hamilton, because, again, I don't think it's realistic, but Quebec City should somehow be ahead of both of those teams. You've got a very deep-pocketed potential owner. You've got a brand-new or almost brand-new rink. You've got a hockey market. You've got rivalries built in there. You've got history.
Isn't the owner considered a separatist?
Well, you're going to have to deal with the Montreal Canadiens then, too. Because they would be, if Quebec separates, Montreal's gone, too.
But I don't think the Molson family are proponents for separation.
No, fair enough. But regardless, if Quebec were to separate, what do you do with the Montreal Canadiens? Maybe they could play out of Hamilton. Did you watch the Masters on the weekend?
I watched quite a bit of it. I didn't watch as much as I normally would. Susan and I were attending to a couple grandkids, which when they're 3 and 5 is a full-time gig. Mm. And I was working Saturday, as I often am. And so I didn't get to see as much of it as I wanted to, but it's what you've been there. I saw, is it Scheffler? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, Scotty Scheffler, the guy who won.
Yep, teeing off. I teed off at like 2:40. And they had a camera behind the tee blocks. And it looked like no human being had ever walked on that tee before. There wasn't a mark on it. And how they keep that place looking like that. And they have some new camera angles now that you had talked about, the hills and undulations and everything else there, and their drives. And they showed where they landed. And the people were walking like 70, looked like 70 feet below that. So they hit it over this big gully. I got thinking, I'd roll a cart over because I probably couldn't make the gully the first hit. I mean, the place is so spectacular.
It really is. It really is. And I, you know, we were looking up on the weekend because we were curious. I was sitting with my son's girlfriend. We were talking about the Masters and stuff. And she goes, do they have members? And I said, yeah, they have members. But I had no idea how many. So we looked it up. There are typically about 300 members. You can't apply to be a member of Augusta National. You are invited only and recommended. And then it says it's believed that the membership fees are up to $300,000 a year. So we started doing some math of what 300 members paying $300,000 a year brings you to. It's about $90 million, if my math is right. Plus whatever money CBS is paying to Augusta National to broadcast, plus the millions of dollars they get in merchandise sales every day during the tournament. We figured that they probably, minimum, that course is probably bringing in about $160 million a year. You can afford to have the greatest grounds crew on planet Earth to make sure that it looks like it does, if that's the case.
Sue says, when do they stop members playing there? I said, I don't know. You may know. It's probably a couple months out.
Yeah, I think so.
And the guys will start wandering in. I said, I would imagine Tiger can show up whenever he wants to play a practice round. And there'll be a few guys like that that can.
I think anybody who has been invited, so who in other words has qualified, is allowed to come in and play. Yeah. To do it.
And I imagine if you've won the Masters, you maybe have the privilege to play there if you'd like to.
Yeah.
But I said to her, I said, my understanding is that there are members from all across the United States. And I would think that if you're in Phoenix, not watching hockey, and you're a member of Augusta, then you may only go there two or three times a year.
Yep.
Because you will have your own palatial golf course or three. And the $300,000 a year to the members is like tip money for you and I going to the Thirsty Cactus.
So here are some of the members, according to the interwebs. Warren Buffett.
Yep, I'm sure he's out there four or five times.
Well, he's 207 years old, so I don't imagine he's playing all that often. He can buy the whole place if he wanted to, but yep. Bill Gates, again, not someone I see as much of a golfer, but, you know, Roger Goodell, commissioner of the NFL. It's a weird list. Rob Manfred, commissioner of Major League Baseball. Peyton Manning is a member. Don't know. Jack Nicklaus. Let's see. Condoleezza Rice. Annika Sorenstam, Hall of Fame golfer. Lynn Swan, former NFL player. Deceased members include Dwight D. Eisenhower. His cottage is right by the 18th green.
Really?
Where he used to go when he was president. And Arnold Palmer. T-Boone Pickens, one of the all-time great Southern names. Jack Welch, former CEO of General Electric. Anyway, it's a fascinating place. But let's get to the Masters for a second, because I was in a weird kind of perverse way hoping for something to play out yesterday, which would have been the toughest decision ever. I don't know if you heard this, that Scotty Scheffler, who won the tournament, who was tied for the lead, his wife was great with child and ready to give birth at any moment. And he had said leading up to the final round, if I get told that she's in labor, I'm out of here. Doesn't matter where I am in the course, doesn't matter where I am in this leaderboard, doesn't matter whatever. I get the note that she is started labor, I'm packing up and I'm leaving.
And I bet he would have.
So I think he probably would have too, because you become the all-time hero to every family person, everybody yeah. who's got a fan. But how much do you think it? How much do you think that decision was made easier if it had happened with him saying that, having already won before? What if he had never yeah. won before? He's already got a green jacket. He's already got an entry for life. He's already got his spot in the. I'm not questioning the man's integrity or his commitment. But when he said that, I thought, I wonder how tough it would be if you had never, if you are Rory McIntyre, or Rory
McIlroy?
McIlroy, thank you. It's getting late. If you're Rory McIlroy, who you need this tournament to win the career Grand Slam, you've been chasing this particular tournament, and your first child is on its way, do you leave to go be with your wife for the birth of your child, or do you go, just squeeze a little longer?
I need
eight more holes.
Where's his wife?
And she was in Dallas.
Yeah, so it's not a 15-minute plane
no,
ride.
I thought that she would be at the hospital in Augusta just in case. But no, she was apparently in Dallas.
I don't know. It's been a long time since I've been pregnant, but I don't think you should be flying if you're about ready to give birth.
True enough, but she could have driven. It's not that far. I mean, it's 12 hours, 14 hours, right? But anyway, regardless.
Talk to your wife about that.
Yeah, but well, yeah, the bouncing might have made her go into labor.
So, but he made the decision, and you know this, knowing he'd already won once.
Yep.
So it wasn't a conversation that he'd never won. And here's what I would speculate, because I understand he's a man of faith.
Yep.
And probably has very high standards, non-comparable to John Daly. And if he's that good to be leading with eight holes to go, he's going, I'll come back and win it next year. Like, if you're that good, he's won three tournaments in a month. It's not like he's new at this.
I also, yeah, it's true. And I wonder what this would have. Now, I mean, whoever ended up winning, if he had left, gets the green jacket, gets all the stuff that goes with it. But does that person forever have the asterisk beside their name that they, like, for example, the example that I would use is, what's his name? The pitcher for the Detroit Tigers who threw the perfect game, but the blown call at first.
Yeah.
Cost him that, but everybody knows he threw a perfect game. It's not officially on the record books, but we all know that he did it. So if he had left,
but that I'm going to interject, which I shouldn't do.
No, go ahead.
That perfect game for that pitcher for Detroit is probably talked about more than any other no-hitter of our lifetime.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So you get
name the guys who have thrown a perfect game in the major leagues. I mean, there's a few. You could come up with it if you... David Wells, David Cone.
1957 Yankee.
Don Larson.
Don Larson did it
in the World Series.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could come up with a few, but most perfect games we don't even remember. That one, though, you're always going to remember.
Right, you always talk about it, right? And you would always talk about, especially if Scheffler won two more, everybody was saying, well, he really won three. Well, he didn't. But you would always say he really won three. Or if he was one behind Tiger, and all of a sudden they're saying, you know, really he's tied with them.
Yeah.
That would be the conversation.
And Ludvig Oberg, who finished second,
yeah.
he would get the green jacket, he would get the money, he would get all the stuff, but there would always, I think, be this thing of,
there'd be a little asterisk there.
He only won because the guy who was winning bailed. It would have been truly, though, one of the most fascinating things to watch in sports ever, that a guy would do that at that moment. Because it wouldn't matter if he was in 45th place.
Was it Nick Price that won the Masters when the shark blew up? Didn't he have...
Could have been. That could be.
The shark blew like a six-shot lead, like in a bunch of them on the back.
I remember watching that tournament and feeling... almost like you could feel yourself clenching. It was so awkward and uncomfortable to watch. Yeah, no, it's but that one, the guy didn't leave. Norman didn't leave.
No, but those when there's oddities involved in it, you're more apt to remember them. I mean, but, we all remember Mike Weir if you're old enough when he won. And so you remember those, but whenever there's an odd twist to something.
Yeah.
I remember Smith in game 7. Oilers Flames, Bank won off Grant Fuhr's
Steve Smith
off Grant Fuhr's leg, and you know, so there's
But again, the closest comparable would be the Oilers got angry about something and left the ice and forfeited that game, which is essentially what this would have been. You're in game seven and you say, we're not playing because we're mad at the ref choice. Or, you know, or Wayne Gretzky. Could you imagine? Like, I could not. It's different in an individual sport because imagine you're Wayne Gretzky. Imagine you're Austin Matthews. Now, I don't think Austin Matthews is married, but let's say Austin Matthews was married and his wife was due to give birth. And you're in game seven of a playoff series and you go, sorry, boys, I got to go be with my wife. Your teammates would kill you, whether it was the right decision or not. And I would argue it probably would be. Your teammates would kill you. But if it's an individual sport, you can do whatever you want. The only guy who's going to kill you is your caddy.
I will tell you, in a playoff, Dundas Real McCoy playoff game, one of our players' wives was ready to give birth.
Yep.
Player gives Tuna the phone and says, if it buzzes or you get a text, she's in labor, come and let me know. And we were about 3 or 4 minutes into the third period. Tuna's down and banging on the glass. He looks up. She'll be fine. Finished the game and went. Now, it was only, he only probably had to stay for another 22, 25 minutes. I mean, we won the game. He was the key player, but he said, she'll be fine. And he made it to the hospital in time, and everything was okay. But
well, I can tell you, we've got to take a break here. I can tell you that I was just thinking of this as we were. So back in 2011, right before McMaster won their first and only Vanier Cup, they had been in the, what was the predecessor to the Vanier Cup in 1967. And the guy who was the starting running back, and I'm just looking up his name here because I, forgive me, I couldn't remember it, Vern Lucic, couldn't make the game that day because he and his wife had their wedding booked and they didn't think they were going to be in the championship, so he went off and got married that day, which was the closest I could ever think to somebody missing that game. They ended up losing that game.
Wow.
But wrote about him, back in 2011. I remember that story.
Hope he's still happily married.
Very happily married still. I don't know if his teams, I don't know if his teammates invite him to the get-togethers anytime soon, but I think it's all fine. Don, I want to take a few minutes here because next Saturday, the Allen Cup begins in Dundas again. And I don't say that as a downside. That's a good thing. It's been here a number of times, the Canadian Senior Hockey Championship. You, Stony Creek Tigers, Alberta, and
Newfoundland. South Shores,
yeah. And
Innisfil, Alberta.
So it starts on Saturday, and it's, what, one game every day?
Yep. All but Wednesday. In my drive to bring prominence back to the Allen Cup, I said last year at the general manager's meeting, I got to be the dumbest guy in this room. The NHL stopped playing Thursday. They start Monday, and we're not playing Saturday, Sunday. Maybe we should play Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Travel schedule with guys getting time off work kind of prohibited that. So we said we're going to play Saturday, Sunday, so we're not fighting the NHL and the Toronto Maple Leafs. So we're doing that. So we stretched the tournament out. So it used to go from Monday to Saturday, and it goes from Saturday to Saturday, which means for Greitmeyer in April, it gives the ice a chance to recover a little bit. You're not running two games a day. So, yes, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, there are games at 7:30. On Wednesday, Newfoundland and Alberta play at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then this, Wednesday night, Stony Creek and Dundas battle it out. Thursday is an off day. Give the ice a chance to recover, and it was also done because the Junior Blues were doing very well, the Junior C team, and we didn't want to disrupt their drawing good crowds. We didn't want to disrupt their playoff run too much. They may have played the Sunday afternoon too. So now they Grimsby knocked them out, so that doesn't that's not going to be a factor now. And then Friday night at 7:30, the semifinal, and at 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon, the championship game will be played the same as it was last year, except this year it's going to be on CHTV.
And hopefully, for you guys, hopefully that's with the ideal would be Dundas and Stony Creek, I'm guessing.
It would be Dundas and anybody.
But Dundas and anybody, there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. If it's Dundas, Stony Creek, the building's full. It was Dundas and Newfoundland last year and the building was full. So we just need to get, we are still in trouble with injuries. And but we've got enough good players. We're going to be, we're going to take a run at this thing. It won't It won't be 2014 when nobody was hurt. That's the perfect scenario. You know, and we've been out because we were injured. So a lot of those guys are going to be back and they're going to be ready to go. So, yes. Last year, Stony Creek and Dundas, or Stony Creek and Hamilton, before they moved to Stony Creek, we were in a semifinal, and we were lucky enough to get the final. And it really makes for a great atmosphere when the local guys are in it.
So first game is Saturday afternoon. Go look up. Where can people find all the stuff?
If you go to realmccoys.ca for the first time, we're now selling only packages online, so you can buy. You can buy 6 preliminary tickets, and we let you use them for whatever game you want. You can come to all 6 games, or you can
share them with friends.
Bring 5 guys to one game, whatever you want to do. And it has a semifinal game, and to perk the package up a little bit, there's 2 tickets to the championship game, and they're $125. So if you're going to go to all the games, it's a great deal. And if you want to split them with somebody, you can split up the preliminary. I don't know what you wrestle over the semifinal, but you can both go to the final. So we tried to get creative, and we think it's worked. We're selling them online. And one day only, Thursday, our executive board are meeting, and we're going to stuff the swag bags for all the players and the officials and everything else. So with J.L. Greitmeyer from 6 till 8 o'clock on Thursday, you'll be able to buy single-game tickets.
There you go, realmccoys.ca or Thursday at Greitmeyer. And that runs all next week. So Don will not be here next week because he's got some coaching to do.
We're going to play Alberta that night. I could wear the headsets.
That would be an interesting show.
You need a full time guy and a beeper, though.
I was just going to say that. Don Robertson, thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks good for luck. The Allen Cup time.
Yeah, good luck next week, and we will have you back in a couple of weeks, hopefully with a new championship hat and championship ring and championship shirt and whatever else you do.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.